Thanks to everyone for coming out this Sunday afternoon at 5 o'clock in Spanish Fort, Utah. Thanks to those who download these talks as podcasts from iTunes. We invite your comments, correspondence, and feedback by emailing us at utahchristianists@gmail.com. We also have a membership class at our website, utahchristianists.org. We'd like to thank those that have become members. We couldn't do what we do without your help and support. Everything is inspired by the teachings of His divine grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, whose statue you see back there. He's the founder acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And because today our topic is the power of smiling, I thought I would do my best to get you smiling with a joke. It was an 85-year-old man walking alone in the woods. No one around that he could see, but he heard a voice that said, "Pick me up." He said, "Where's that voice coming from?" A little bit later, he heard the voice again, "Pick me up." So he looked down and there was a frog. And the frog said, "Pick me up and kiss me and I'll become a beautiful young bride." So he picked the frog up, he put the frog in his pocket and he continued walking. So within the pocket, the frog is saying, "Didn't you hear me? I said, kiss me, I'll become your beautiful young bride." He said, "At my age, I'd rather have a talking frog." I've got you all smiling. Now I can talk about the power of smiling. We're on the same vibration. This is an excerpt by a book by Jeremy Dean called The Benefits of Smiling. Smiling is a signal that suggests we are trustworthy. Studies have shown that people are much more likely to trust by a large percentage people that smile a lot than people that don't smile. And why is that? If you smile, it indicates that you're self-satisfied, you're content, that you're happy, and you don't have a twisted conception of needing to prey upon or manipulate or exploit other people in order to augment your happiness. Many unhappy people think that the way to become happy is to take advantage of other people and to exploit them. Now, if you'll look at some of the pictures of Krishna, which you see around here, you'll see that he's smiling and that he is described in the Sanskrit literatures as purna. That means he's full. God is full. He lacks nothing. It means his pleasure at each and every moment is unlimited and perfectly complete. He lacks nothing. His pleasure, his happiness, is an established fact since eternity. Now, in the spiritual world, as you know, he is loved and served by countless millions and millions and millions of liberated souls. So he has no need to exploit us. He has no need to take advantage of us. Rather, he's situated in such a way as his desire is to enrich us and to augment us and benefit us. So if we look at the face of an ordinary person, they're smiling, it makes us trust them. And how much more can we trust God? And can we trust his smile? And also trust him that his interaction with us is meant to take us to a higher level of richness. So although he's... Now this is a very important point about bhakti. You're studying bhakti, okay? Bhakti means love and devotion. This is a key point, so I want you to listen to this phrase very carefully. Though happy and engaged lovingly with hosts of innumerable, uncountable living entities, both in the spiritual world and on this plane as well, his capacity to love is not exhausted. So because God loves, we know he's a person just like you and I, because we love and he loves, and in fact we get our loving propensity from him. He's the source from which everything comes. But the difference between us and God is that he's unlimited and we're limited. Maybe you love your spouse and you love one or two kids and you have, they say if you have three or four good friends in your life, you're exceptional, you're extraordinary. But we really don't have the capacity to love more than just a handful of people. People, I mean, we would literally give our lives for. But God has the capacity to love each and every one of his innumerable parts and parcels throughout millions and millions of universes, both spiritual and material. Prabhupada once said, "A man will have as many children as he can support. If your income is such, then you'll have two kids because you can support them. If you have more income, you'll have six or eight kids because you can support them. But there's a limit to how many we can support. 10, 12, 14, there's a limit. But God has created all living beings, and he's perfectly capable of supporting each and every one of them. And not only supporting them, but it's over and above putting a roof and food on the table, the kids want some quality time. You can't just provide for them and support them and not give them your love and your undivided attention and quality time. So God has an unlimited capacity to love each and every one of his parts and parcels. So although he's fully engaged in an intimate way with millions and millions of liberated souls in the spiritual world, and a footnote here, one God, many servants. How does that work out? When you get to the spiritual world, because there's one God, do you wait in a long line for 750 trillion years and you get up to God and shake hands, nice to meet you, and then you have to move on because there's a lot of people behind you? No, the nature of God is that he can expand himself. Like one candle can light 10 or 20 other candles, and then those candles are just as powerful as the original. So each and every liberated soul, or each and every group or set of souls, feels that God is with their group only and exclusively. That's the ability of God to satisfy the loving tendencies of his living beings, his parts and parcels. Now, you would think that being so much engaged across the board, that why would God bother? Why would God even be aware or concerned about those of us, those few of us, who are loitering in this material world? And here's the answer. He doesn't create carbon copies. He creates each and every one of you unique. So even though he's got so much loving engagements going on, he still misses what you and you and you and you bring to the table, because each one of us brings something, at least potentially, that no other created living being could bring. And so he's missing us in some part of his consciousness. Just like a father is home on Saturday morning, he doesn't have to go to work, so he gets up early. He's got 5 sons, and 3 of his sons get up with him, and they're out playing, wrestling in the grass, throwing the football around, having a great time, hugging each other. And the father's happy. He's perfectly happy and satisfied doing that. But on some level of his consciousness, he wishes those other 2 sleepyheads would also get up and come down and join in the fun. And God has the capacity not only to support, but to enter into deep, meaningful, loving relationships with each and every one of his parts and parcels. If he didn't have that capacity, he wouldn't have created us in the first place. Now, when we worship him respectfully, formally, religiously, that actually pains him. He wants something much more intimate. He doesn't like the fact that we keep him at arm's length, and he tries to close the gap between us. It is said that you can attract more flies with honey than you can with vinegar. Now, never understand why anyone would want to attract flies in the first place, but the point is that you attract a lot more people by being nice than you do by being grouchy. Personal warmth melts social barriers, and it eases natural reserve. So I've had this question for some time, and I'd like to share with you my question. You see Krishna here. Krishna is our name for God. He's all attractive, all strong, all beautiful, all knowing, all wealthy, all famous, and also all youthful. When you think about it, God would never be an old man, because he's eternal. Eternal means he never dies. And the fact that he never dies means that what else does he not do? He never gets old. So when you think about it, God would never be old. And how much fun would it be to go to the spiritual world and keep your voice down? God's taking his afternoon nap. No ice cream today. God's watching his blood pressure. Yeah. So anyway, here's Krishna, beautiful, youthful, standing in a threefold bending form. A flute to his lips, yellow clothes like lightning, peacock feathers stuck in his hair, big smile on his face. Now, you'd be hard-pressed to find another picture which is more attractive, more inviting, completely non-judgmental, non-exclusive. So my question is, why is it that many of his followers look and dress and talk like undertakers? Can anyone answer that question for me? I got a big laugh when I said that in Salt Lake City. Oliver Wendell Holmes, the famous court justice, he confessed he was the longest serving and most prolific of all the court justices, the Supreme Court justices. He confessed that in his youth he had thought of joining the clergy, but he decided against it because so many of them looked and talked like undertakers. So Krishna is not exclusive, and he doesn't need us to judge, to screen, to cull, and to cast out those who we deem are unworthy. We're all worthy just in the fact that we're created by God's almighty hand. Every one of us is created by the master craftsman, and being created by God, he loves us, and there's nothing that you'll ever do to get God to stop loving you or to get him to stop trying to do good for you. Now, having said that, God will always love you. That doesn't mean that he approves of everything that you do. C.S. Lewis says this, God's love must be impeded and repelled by certain stains in our present character. And because he already loves us, he must work with us to make us lovable. We're created from God. He's pure, so we're pure. But some or other, we've allowed ourselves to become stained. Like a drop of water, when it descends from the heavens, it's pristine and pure, but as soon as it hits the dirt, it becomes muddy. So God works with us to get us, to extract us from the material contaminations, material appetites, material ambitions that affect us in this material world in contact with matter, to make us more lovable so that we can then enjoy the fruits of his unlimited affection for us. So C.S. Lewis goes on to say, what we call here and now our happiness is not the end that God has in mind for us, but when we are such that he can love us without impediment, we shall then in fact be happy. Does that make sense? As Krishna enchants and attracts with his smile, a smile is the greatest tool for taking greater ground for the kingdom. The spiritual world, the kingdom of God, in Sanskrit is called Vaikuntha. Kunta means worry, stress, frustration, anxiety. And when you put Vai in front of something in Sanskrit, it negates it. So the spiritual world is that place where there's no stress, there's no worry, there's no anxiety. So when we, in our family, and in our school, and in our workplace, when we smilingly, lovingly, and supportively encourage warm, intimate, trusting relationships. I once talked to a teacher. She had a student from Mountain View High who was accepted at Harvard with a full scholarship and BYU with no scholarship. And she chose to go to BYU for the very same reason that I was talking, because there's a supportive, warm, loving environment there, which she didn't think that she would encounter at Harvard University. So when you smile, and when you're warm, and when you're attractive, you create the very same attitude, atmosphere that exists in the spiritual world. So you're taking ground for him. Now, God created everything. He's called Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. He put all the worlds into existence, and his intention in creating all the planets was that his property be divided equally amongst his sons. His intention was not that we artificially cut up his property and name one section India, another section Bangladesh, another section Pakistan, Sri Lanka, France, Brazil, United States of America. And now you find that in a place, say, like Bangladesh, people are packed together too densely. And there are vast spaces of Africa that are totally uninhabited. Prabhupada said on one occasion, why not allow some of the people from, say, Bangladesh to go and give them some land so they can grow food in Africa? Why not? Because that's violating our national sovereignty. That will contravene laws of immigration. But God's intention was that his property is equally available to all of his parts and parcels. Isavashim idam sarvam yat kinjad yagachim duvat. One should take only what is set aside as one's own quota and leave the rest, knowing well to whom it belongs. So all of our nationalism and chest thumping, our high-minded and high-worded constitutions and declarations of independence smack of the slightest bit of hypocrisy. Einstein said nationalism is an infantile disease. It is the measles of humanity. So many times the teachers, you all go back to your teacher and they say, how was it? And they say, oh yeah, it's just what we believe. It's just what we believe. And the teachers say, no, you've got to get things stirred up, you see. You've got to get things stirred up. So we're just trying to stir things up a little bit here. One time, a group of thieves, they robbed a bank, they evaded their pursuers, they got to their hideout, and they were in the process of dividing the goods when one thief was overheard to say, come on, guys, let's divide it morally. Where is the question of morality when it's stolen property? So all land is God's land. It's God's land. 300 years ago, this was not the United States of America. And 300 years from now, it will not be called the United States of America. So it's not our land. It's not Frenchman's land. It's not Brazilian's land. It's God's land. And he intends that we should divide it up equally. And as it is God's intention that we not divide ourselves and separate ourselves and put ourselves at odds with each other over artificial concoction of nationalism, it's also his intention that we see others as non-different from ourselves. That we not see based on the external bodies, the gender, the ethnicity, the economic status, but we see that within each and every body, whether we be blonde or male or female or Mexican or African American or Caucasian, that within each and every body there's a divine spark, part and parcel of God. Therefore, we're all sisters and brothers in the same spiritual family. So we need to learn to see others as non-different from ourselves. Pandita Samadarshana. We are all God's children. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, Aham Bija Pradapita. He claims that he is the seed-giving father of all living beings. We need each other. We need to stand together and to support each other. We are better together. And yet, when we get challenged, when we get stressed out, what's the first knee-jerk reaction that we do? We circle the wagons and we isolate ourselves. Isn't it? One Harvard study said, the secret in navigating life and having the most successful, purposeful life probably lies in a person's ability to handle life's blows without blame, without bitterness, and without isolation. The study goes on to say that one potent predictor of well-being was the ability to handle crises maturely and socially. But instead, we become cranky, we become uptight, we push people away when we need them the most. The more pressure you feel, the more we should look for opportunities to smile, to share a laugh, and draw people to us. When you think about it, the worst part of every problem is having to face it alone and in isolation. So if you're smiling, if you're warm-hearted, if you make people want to be good to you, then you've already solved the worst part of any problem before the problem even occurs. Over and above that, scientific studies have shown smiling people live longer. They took a picture of all the baseball players in the American Baseball League in 1952. And they tracked them throughout life and even up to the end of their lives. Amazingly, the baseball players who were smiling in the pictures lived an average of 7 years longer than their non-smiling counterparts. Smiling boosts the immune system. It sends healing oxygen through the body. It releases feel-good endorphins. And it only takes 26 muscles to smile, 74 muscles to frown. Well, if that's not something to smile about, I don't know what is. These days, all we hear are constant reports of gloom and doom. Trouble in the economy, higher taxes, home foreclosures, tight job market. If you're not careful, you can fall into the trap of thinking, this is no time to enjoy my life. This is no time to have fun. This is no time to have a sense of humor. And yet it's a fact that some of the greatest comedians in the world grew up in inner city ghettos where there were so many problems, crime, illegitimacy, unemployment, drug abuse, but they learned to cope with their environment through laughing at it, through humor. It is said that if you can laugh at it, you can live with it. In hard times, it's more important than ever to activate your joy, to keep your creativity and keep your visions for the future flowing. If you become depressed, your brain shuts down at the very time that you need it the most. Research shows that people who are stuck by a problem do much better after they've had a good laugh. Laughing activates the left side, the creative side of the brain. Without laughter, our thought processes become stunted and stuck, our focus narrows, and our problem-solving abilities are hindered. If you laugh, your mind lights up, you come up with fresh ideas and make better decisions as a result. I remember once when I was a teenager, I was watching a national championship football game on TV. It wasn't BYU. And one team, prior to the game, was heavily favored. One team was the underdog. And sure enough, with just about a minute to go, the favored team was 6 points ahead. The underdogs were backed up with no timeouts on their own 20-yard line, and it was 4th and 15. So I saw on the screen one quarterback, and he was laughing and smiling and clapping his mates on the back, telling jokes, and I thought, well, he must be the quarterback of the favorite team that's well ahead, and he thinks the game is in the bag, and that explains his light mood. But I looked again, and he was wearing the uniform of the team, which was the underdog, which was on their own 20-yard line with no timeouts and fourth and huge amounts to go. Well, sure enough, on the last play of the game, he wound up and he threw a 60-yard pass. It was caught for the winning touchdown. Now, it occurred to me at the time that if he'd been all stressed, if he'd been all wound up and constipated and constrained and uptight, he wouldn't have been able to throw that ball as far, as long, and as accurately as he did. What do you think? Now, if you're in a world religion class and you've studied the Bhagavad Gita, I think you'll agree with me that in the entire history of the world, there's no more tense, potentially stressful situation than that in which the Bhagavad Gita opens up. There are two armies facing each other. They're cousins, brothers, teachers, friends, and they're about to engage in a fratricidal world war. And Arjuna, who is a Herculean Olympian hero, fought many, many battles before. The particular circumstances of having to fight and to kill his own teachers and relatives and cousins have completely unmanned him. This big decathlon Olympian is crying, he's dropped his bow, he's trembling, he's literally paralyzed. So Krishna begins to pour confidence, to begin to pour knowledge. But the first thing that Krishna does in the midst of all this, they're outnumbered, they're outmanned, the circumstances don't look good, it looks like darkness is about to descend on the whole world. What does Krishna do? He smiles. Before he starts talking to Arjuna, he smiles. He didn't have any reason to smile, but smiling is in itself enough of a reason to smile. And as soon as Krishna smiled, his enemies gnashed their teeth. They lost their confidence. They said, what is Krishna smiling about? He must know something we don't know. Why is he so joyful? Why does he look so healthy? And the hearts of the bad guys sunk when they saw Krishna smiling as if he didn't have a care in the world. Took away all their poise and all their confidence. He'd already won the psychological part of the battle. Before a single javelin was thrown, single thrust, before a single arrow was shot, Krishna already had the opponents on the ropes by the power of his smile. If you're taking a world religions course, you also study about Maya. Maya is the agent of the illusory energy, and her job is to keep you revolving on samsara, the repeated cycle of birth, death, disease, and old age. Maya likes nothing more than to allow tension and strife and worry into your life. When that happens, she's got you right in the palm of her hand. So make sure there's plenty of laughter in your home, plenty of laughter in your dormitory, plenty of laughter in your workplace, and especially plenty of laughter in your temples. We all have wells of joy inside of us, and our greatest tool for taking ground for the kingdom is laughter. So don't be stingy. Don't squander your laughter. Krishna, the reservoir of pleasure, the Anandam Buddhi Vardhanam, the very source of pleasure, has taken up residence. God, the ultimate pleasure-giving living being, resides within each and every one of our hearts. So don't you dare go around with a hangdog, depressed, nothing good ever happens to me, I never get the breaks attitude. No. When we were children, these wells of happiness and pleasure, they flowed freely. We laughed and we played with our friends and we enjoyed each and every moment. Did you know that the average child laughs 300 times a day and the average adult laughs only 15 times a day? As we got older, these wells, they got clogged up with bits and pieces of stones and sand and gravel and rocks, the stones of disappointment, stress and doubt, they started blocking and restricting the flow. So we chant the holy names of God. Nobody in the history of the world, whether it be Jehovah, Allah, Adonai, has chanted any bona fide name of God and not lightened up, not put a big smile on their faces. That's why we chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We already have the all blissful Lord within our hearts, but we need to invoke him externally. Just like there's fire in this wood, but it's only when you bring fire externally in the form of the match that it's released.